Good morning. My name's Phil Doran. I'm delighted to be presenting the second session this morning, Identifying Emerging Risks, and introduce our two speakers, Richard and Neil. I work for Accenture and have the pleasure of working there, looking after the finance and risk practice. And like many organisations, Accenture's currently in the process of enabling disruption for organisations. It's doing implementations around blockchain, fintech, robotics, liquid workforce. And the challenge with all of these is there's no doubt about the benefits of them, but there's significant risks associated with implementation of these as well. So we're attempting to help both finance and risk functions to understand what those risks are and to enable the business to implement them effectively and successfully. Using traditional quantification methodologies around these emerging risks is particularly challenging, and we're working with a couple of banks at the moment who are significantly out of risk appetite on cyber risk. For two reasons. One, because the traditional methodologies are challenged in understanding what these risks are, but also the velocity of these risks is completely different to traditional risks of what organisations are managing. Fortunately, today we've got two experts to talk us through how to identify these risks. There'll be a opportunity for questions at the end with a microphone as before, and the best questions today will win an iPad mini. Our first speaker is Richard Fodor. Richard is the Chief Operating Officer of Swiss Re for Australia and New Zealand, with 20 years' experience analysing, communicating financial information, risks, and operational performance across Australia and North America. Richard was a member of the team that developed the first risk framework in both AMP and IAG, before leading the risk team in IAG's personal insurance division. In 2010, he joined Wesfarmers to help turn around the performance of the company and bring consistency and approach and culture across the three operating performance divisions. So welcome, Richard.
Phil, thank you for the introduction, and thank you to the Institute and everyone here for welcoming me to today's presentation. I will start out with just a couple of proverbs. So I'm a proud Egyptian and proud of my heritage. And just want to go back to what my fellow Arabs say about the future and about risk. So nothing stays the same. What is coming is better than what has gone. And then finally, what is still hidden is more than what has happened and all been revealed so far. In other words, this is just the tip of the iceberg. As I mentioned, I am proud of my Egyptian heritage, as is my grandfather, or was my grandfather. He was born in a very, very different era, born into almost a bubble in Cairo. So he was born into a life of privilege, could trace his lineage back to one of the seven tribes of Arabia, and grew up into being the foreign minister in the middle part of the last century in King Farouk's hierarchy. He couldn't imagine a world that was different to the one he'd been born into, because obviously he had a wealth of history that told him that nothing would ever change. My grandmother, his wife, was very different. So she came from Turkey. She came to Egypt through an arranged marriage. And while it wasn't necessarily a union of love, it became a union that was very beneficial to both of them. So she was a mother of two. She didn't know what the next day would hold, because she wasn't in control of her life. But in the late 40s and early 50s, she started to see a pattern happening in the country, in Egypt. There was civil unrest. This is a period that was tumultuous for most of the world. So everyone was going through the post-World War II era. There was the rise of socialist thoughts within certainly the Middle East, and in particular in Egypt. And she started to piece together an emerging risk for my family. My grandfather, as I said, couldn't imagine what was going to happen, and certainly tried to ignore almost what was happening in the country. She brought a conversation to the table, to the dinner table, to both my father and my aunt, and to my grandfather, and started to draw strands together to say, this is a problem for us. And finally, through those conversations at the dinner table, in 1952, just before it turned very bad for our family, they packed up everything that they'd had, left behind a lot of what they had, and turned their back on hundreds of years' worth of history in the Middle East, and came to Australia, of all places. I'm thankful that they did. I'm thankful that my grandmother saw an emerging risk in my family, but more importantly, that she brought that conversation to the table. And that's a part of the theme of what I'll say today, is that there are no right and wrong answers around emerging risks per se, because they are just foretelling of the future. The wrong thing is not to have the conversation. Probably worth just pausing and having a look at a definition around it. There are a number of definitions, but I think they all tend towards the same idea, and that is that emerging risks tend to be newly developing or changing risks, and ones that are difficult to quantify. I know Neil will go into a bit of that in his session after me, but and obviously people in this room are much better at quantifying emerging risks than I am, but they are by their very nature amorphous. They're very difficult to understand. But what they have in common is that they have potentially a major impact on society, industry, and the organizations we work in. A few examples that Swiss Re look at, and we tend to scan across the industry and use a number of different sources, but we look at this point in time about 21 emerging themes, and these are just four of them. So gamification, which when I look at my 9-year-old son, I think frightens the hell out of me. So it's this concept about our world can look very different in terms of how we look through the lens of the video games that this generation is using at the moment. So how does that influence industry, but also interaction socially going forward? I don't understand it, but by its very nature could potentially have a major impact, both positive and negative, on all of us in the future. I think we all probably either used Airbnb or Uber at some point, so the sharing economy has enormous advantages for us personally, but what does it mean as a disruption to a number of industries? And we're seeing that in the hotel industry, we're seeing it obviously in the taxi industry, but it has flow-on effects to a number of other industries. So again, it has unknown impacts to a number of industries, and the nature of emerging risk is to understand that and to start to look at what could happen down the track. Digital identities, we all pretty much have a digital identity now. We understand, and this is probably one that sits more on the emerged rather than the emerging spectrum, but the concept of cyber risk and the fact that we are far more likely to share information on digital platforms and the risk that they then hold is one that obviously we need to look at both as individuals but as well as companies. And the last one is about the crisis of trust. This is only the fourth of a number of examples we're looking at, but this concept that has taken hold since the global financial crisis, that the trust in industry, the trust in organizations, and the trust in government has eroded over time. And we heard obviously earlier today about Brexit and the crisis of trust that existed and continues to exist in the UK with Europe. In line with the theme of today's session, I'd like to then explore a practical approach to the identification and the assessment of emerging risk. There are essentially four stages that we look at in terms of identifying emerging risk. There is an observation phase, a discussion phase, as I said, the dinner table for my family back in Egypt in the early 50s, and a preparation, and ultimately what we would hope for is a resilience phase that comes from looking at emerging risk. Observation involves not just, I would hope, the CRO, not just the CEO, not just potentially the head of sales or a specialist, but the combination of a number of specialist voices around a number of tables. The concept that we hear from one or two voices at a board meeting is potentially flawed, and we heard that from David earlier today, that what that should be is consolidation of a number of different voices that have come to the table. So that can happen from internal specialists within your organizations. It can come from external advisors such as Accenture. It can come from thought leadership papers, whether it come from Swiss Re or World Economic Forum. But the important point is to really draw together a number of different thoughts and see how does that potentially apply to your organization now, but also your organization of the future. I can't understate the need as well to just slog through research. These things are, by their very nature, unknown. There's a lot of research that needs to go into understanding what might happen, what this future might look like, and present different options back to the table. To illustrate the observation phase a little bit further, it's as organized as that. So there are strands that come from all over, from lots of different sources. The important aspect is then to try and draw that into some sort of theme. So almost like, I think as Brett said earlier today, we wouldn't have many equations today. This is probably as close as I get to an equation. It's the consolidation of a number of different thoughts into what sort of theme does this result in for our organisation. And they are very, uncertain themes, but they start the conversation at the management table or at the board table. As I said, Neil will go into some ideas about how we would do that in a statistical sense in his presentation. The key idea is really just to draw them together. I'd like to now move on to the practical considerations on how you actually had that conversation. So how do you do the observation, but also the discussion? And I've got six challenges that I would think everyone in this room would have to go through to try and consider how do you come up with emerging risks. The first one is the very nature of the fact that these are unknowns. They may not be a fact base to what this future looks like or the emerging trend might be. And it takes imagination and courage to bring it to the table. If there's one lesson I've learned in trying to bring identifying emerging risks to a boardroom or a management table, it's that the power of storytelling excites people's mind rather than the pure raw data. And I don't mean to offend anyone in the room, but there has to be a combination of both. The attempt to try and talk about a 1 in 7,000 year event doesn't excite the mind of a board member as much as talking about, say, an earthquake under Collins Street in Melbourne. So the storytelling is vital in trying to bring together this idea of the unknown, but also the fact that we are wedded in our present situation. I also have reflected in the past about the fact that a lot of these things are probably a bit like the Emperor's New Clothes, that at some point in time, someone knows something about what might happen in the future. They've got an idea about it, or they've seen it in their past. So we understand what the Emperor's New Clothes was, and that is that either the person had no mechanism to voice their idea or their observation, or that they assumed someone else was doing something about it. I think our role as risk facilitators is to break down those paradigms and to say, we will give you that opportunity to have that conversation to identify that emerging trend or that risk, but also we'll break down this notion that someone else is doing something about it. It doesn't matter if they are. The more people that identify something, the better it is. Rather hear it 7 times than to not hear it at all. So the Emperor's New Clothes is an important consideration when thinking about identifying emerging risk, that we shouldn't make assumptions that someone else is doing something about it. Facilitate the observations from every part of the organisation. It shouldn't just be the domain of the leadership team. I think another consideration trying to overcome, a hurdle to overcome in thinking about identifying emerging risk, is there is no practical output at times. So to command the attention of a board or a leadership team for what essentially might be a minute from a meeting is difficult. People are time poor, and to ask them to come together to talk about something that doesn't result in a product or any revenue or even a 10-page document is difficult. So that's where the trust, the credibility of the people in this room come to bear. So we can talk about the fact that emerging risks have emerged over time. We can talk about we can leverage the value that we've already provided in organizations, but it's also ultimately a leap of faith. So it's asking boards and senior management to come together to talk about something that may never happen. And when they're thinking just about the next quarter's return or the next 12 months business plan, that's a difficult challenge to overcome. So to be able to devote the time comes down to your influence. An important one, and I know Brett spoke about it to me prior to this session, is the fact that these things don't necessarily happen in isolation. So an emerging risk could be the combination of a number of disparate events. NASA, in their analysis of both the Challenger and Columbia disasters over the last 20 years, reflected on the fact that there was no single event that led to the loss of both of those crews. It was the combination of the renewal of a, certainly in the Challenger situation, the renewal of a contractor's contract with NASA. It was the weather that they hadn't anticipated, the cold weather in the morning of the launch in Challenger, and the testing that had been put into the O-rings that sealed the gas going into the solid rocket booster, and the testing that no one had imagined was deficient. So the combination of those things in a complex system led to an emerging risk. It isn't necessarily just one thing. It's not necessarily just digital identities, but also potentially the behavior of people in the organization, the way that process was designed in the past, and potentially also external factors. So to think about the consolidation of those things together in a scenario is a challenge. So again, the storytelling, I think, is quite helpful in trying to bring those disparate aspects together. Finally, bringing people, many opinions together is a difficult challenge. So as I said earlier, you don't want a single voice trying to lead these things. You don't want just a think tank. You don't want just a report by Swiss Re. You also want as many data points as you can. But how do you bring that together? I won't say that I'm going to solve that today for you, but the key in the conversation that you have at a management team or a board is the facilitation and allowing the many voices within that room to then imagine what might happen. So to draw the inferences from the hypotheticals through to what might happen and the range of options that might face your organization. Once again, I think the trust that you build with your organization is key in being able to facilitate these conversations. In terms of the next stage, I would classify preparation as preparation on a curve. The last thing you can do is trying to define a course of action for a specific future event. I think what we're trying to do is really to understand a range of options that could occur, design responses or a range of options in terms of responses to these things, and have them apply as these emerging risks start to become emerged or we start to see indicators affect our business. Shell is an organization that most people understand has been doing scenario planning since the early 70s, since the OPEC crisis. They're very good at this. They're very good at thinking about the future, but equally, I don't think they're very good at predicting the future. And I don't think they pride themselves on that either. But the best example of the way that played out for them, where they used scenario planning and thinking about emerging risk, was in the Hurricane Katrina disaster, in that they had imagined the loss of a building in America or somewhere around the world. They had a range of options that they could do to recover, they could put in place to recover their operations and people, but they hadn't imagined it was going to happen in New Orleans. But in applying the range of options that they had on the table from their scenario planning to that specific emerged risk, they were able to get everyone out of the building in record time, beat FEMA to the disaster zone, recover their operations within 72 hours in Houston, Texas, and actually now enable themselves to be an example used today by me. So they came out of that with a positive story, but more importantly also were able to recover their operations fairly quickly based on their past planning of imagining a scenario that may occur, not necessarily that exact scenario. The reward for all of that then is resilience. And the resilience comes from understanding what those emerging risks might look like to us. So people having that language, having their antennae ready to see that things are changing in their business, but equally understanding how do you map the range of options at a moment's notice to something that is emerging or has emerged. It's far easier if you've had these conversations, if you've thought about these things, if you know how to bring the teams together, if you know how to enact the controls, if you've had the conversation before the disaster or before the emerging risk has come to bear. My final message to you after all of that is it's a hard exercise to get through, but I think we just need to breathe. Thank you.
Many thanks, Richard. Fantastic. Our next speaker is Neil Allen. Neil recently arrived back in Sydney after 12 years in the UK running a successful risk management consultancy practice, where he specialised in using system-based approaches and his applied research. He worked for organisations such as Rio, British Gas, Prudential, RSA and Babcock's to implement strategic risk management, different policies around risks, frameworks, processes, emerging risk techniques, emerging risk modelling and cultural alignment initiatives, including risk culture audits. Neil is an active member of the UK's ICE Actuary Committee, responsible for the Risk and Management of Projects series of publications, and led the research and writing of specialist reports on strategic risk and enterprise risk management. He has also authored the Institute of Risk Management's new guidance for the extended enterprise and was lead author on the Construction Industry Research and Information Industries Guide for Engaging with Risk on complex projects. Please welcome Neil.
Thanks very much. I'd just like to say you've said welcome. I've moved back to Sydney. I've just moved. I've not come back, though I've been on holiday here before. And I didn't work for RIA and those companies. They were just clients. Okay, clearing up all that in case I get sort of sued. I'd like to thank Richard because I think he's given me a really nice segue into my session, and that was our detailed planning, wasn't it, Richard? Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to come at, well, maybe think about emerging risks in a slightly different way. And I think what's already been alluded to here is that I'm looking at this through the lens of a complex systems analysis, which I sort of have been doing for about the last 15 years and applying that approach to risk, which really was sparked by the work that I did do for the actuaries and the DTI in the UK. It was a three-year study looking at strategic risk, and suddenly I realised that sort of the traditional ways that we're looking at an event-based view of the world in risk management and just didn't really work. So some of the things about complex systems when you look at them is they're about connections, they're about interrelatedness, they're about network effects, they're about feedback and dynamics, a lot of what we've heard from speakers earlier this morning, I think. And also evolution. So complex systems adapt and evolve. And so the definition that Richard put up about sort of developing, newly developing and changing, you know, very similar words. So I'm going to go with that definition because I know there's quite a lot floating around out there. So what I'm going to try and look at is just give a very brief overview of what do we mean then? What can we use from evolutionary theory to apply to emerging risks? And then maybe how we can look at that also to look at maybe how we can network and hopefully deal with that clustering bit that Richard's mentioned in the middle there when they were identifying risks and how we can maybe use the models that are available to us without any equations, I promise, to go through this. So I think you probably know what I mean by evolution. If we have a tree of life or any sort of tree that is and this is typically come from biology where the species are mapped based on certain characteristics that they have. And now, of course, we have the power of DNA to dig really much deeper into all of this. But cladistics, which is formally called phylogenetic systematics, but that is a bit of a mouthful, is really the study of evolutionary characteristics that occur between living and non-living. So these techniques have been applied to language, famously by Pagel in the UK, looking at the evolution of different languages. They've been used in industrial context and even by pharmaceutical companies looking for the next generation of bacterias so that they can develop something ahead of when it actually appears because of the long lead time in development. So I think we've all kind of, we're all happy with what a tree of life looks like. If you're not really happy with that one, I saw this online while I was at it as well. That's Pokemon tree of life. Now that is bizarre, and I don't even want to go that. It doesn't even seem to follow any sort of biology that we know. But for the younger people, I'm sure that kind of means more than the first diagram. So here I'm always worried that I put up this black swan and we're going to get into a whole sort of Rumsfeld debate about this. But of course, this was something that Taleb has used to indicate what he means by an unexpected, something that couldn't have been foreseen. Now, I sort of challenge that a little bit because, yes, the early Europeans thought all there was white swans. They didn't look any further because white swans looked lovely and regal and all those sort of nice things. It wasn't until in the 1600s that someone spotted a black swan in Australia. And in fact, they still didn't believe this explorer that they'd spotted a black swan until somebody else caught two black swans and took them back to Europe and said, here you go, here's the evidence. So if we had an evolutionary understanding, that might not have been such a surprise. So we have black birds, we have black and white birds, we have sort of whitish coloured birds. Swans are actually even grey when they go from, young cygnet into a big swan. So, you know, we've got ducks that are black and are white, some of them are white and black, and we've even got swans that have got black necks. So my point here is, had we just thought, well, could a swan be a different colour? Is there any evidence around of other characteristics of swans that would maybe give us a clue that it could maybe be black? So all you Taleb lovers, I know, and a very engaging book, maybe that's not quite such a radical thing as we might like to think. He also kind of pinched the idea, I think, or sort of borrowed the idea from Karl Popper, who was using it as a way to show about falsification approaches to creating new theory and a scientific approach. So, hope you're all with me still. So, it's not an equation, but I appreciate that's a matrix on the left-hand side there, but it's not too scary, honest. Actually, I'm just going to flip back here, because I just wanted to stress this point here I've written, is that, for me, emerging risks nearly always have are combinations of known risk characteristics. Nearly always we can find that. And I can't really think of many that are not, but I'm sure there'll be a question on it. So what do we mean by these characteristics and how can this help? So in a very simple example of this, if we look at, we can list the characteristics across the top here, paired fins, jaws, large dermal bones, etc., etc. And we have a number of potential species down on the column. And we can just sort of say, is that characteristic present or not? Much easier than DNA, which has four states. This is much easier. And what we can first see is that the lamprey, which is a very attractive looking animal found in Scotland, I don't think it has any eyes, it just has a rasping tongue. And you can spot those in Glasgow just after kicking out time, actually. But all they have is a rasping tongue. And that's how they differ from all of the other species that we have here. And it's very simplistic. Just kind of go with me a little bit. So then we can see that a shark is different because it's got no large dermal bones in there. It's sort of like big shoulder blade type things. But yet they do have some characteristics in common. So they have paired fins, and they've got fin rays, and they've got jaws, which we probably know. Okay, so then we end up with, at the more advanced end of this evolutionary tree that have grown here, we've got salmons and lizards. Now, all very well, you might say. But that's a way of categorising these different species via their characteristics. And that's the power of it. So it's looking at characteristics, not getting obsessed with what the risk is. So if we can find the characteristics, we might be able to get some clue to what goes on. And then it allows us to do things like, well, what if this characteristic was present in a lizard? Now, what we do know from evolutionary theory, that's much more likely than this character emerging onto that species, okay? Because it's less of an evolutionary jump. Now, what is that? This is fin rays. This is sort of like a bony fin. Now, we do actually see those on lizards. It's not in my tree, but you do see lizards that have, dragon lizards have sort of like a whole collar that comes up, which are actually fin rays. So, you know, that characteristic has then, as we say, emerged onto that. And that would be, for me, a new emerging risk, if these were risks. Hope you're with me so far. Okay. This is a sort of a set of data. We're doing some work for an organisation called ORIC, ORIC International, and I know some of you, AMP, are members of that. And they are a member organisation. And they've recently done an emerging risk survey with their members, and we're going to help them applying some of these techniques to see what we can understand from that data. And it's well-collected data. It's consistently collected, and they have very rich descriptions, which kind of goes back to, I think, Richard's point that, you know, let's talk about what we mean by these emerging risks and put it on the table, but make that conversation as rich as possible. Get as much of information out in those discussions, in your workshops as possible. Jot it down. We can use that in this technique. And in fact, they've used some automatic tagging on that data as well to give us the characteristics we're after. I had no control of the selection of those characteristics, so I might do it slightly differently. But here we have it. And this is a very small sample. And what I've essentially done is just put this into a bit of software, which is not particularly special or anything. And it gives us this evolutionary tree for... this was just two organisations' data. And what we do see from this, I hope, is these are clusters. These are families. These are clades. And each one of them here I've given a name, which is defined by this characteristic on each of them. So, interestingly, these are, you know, statutory and regulatory changes. I think I heard that this morning. We've certainly got technology as a broad bucket there. Yep, I think we'd all agree with that. Pandemic and health is another cluster. And this bottom one is a little bit interesting for me, but it's around claims. It's about underwriting experience of these new emerging risks. And it's also pulling in, for me, one of the fastest evolving areas, which is this bit here. So the number of steps here now is important. This is the evolutionary length that's going on here and how rapid it's happening. So where we see more evolution happening, that's where you look for new emerging risks. So you look for new species in the biological world where the most species are. So around the equator, in energy-rich areas. So, you know, technology, for example, is an area where it's evolving very, very rapidly. That's where you might expect to get, from evolutionary theory, to get new emerging issues coming out of. And also it's where the energy is. So where's the energy in your organisation or the emerging risk world? And let's proxy that for maybe cash, money, resources. Where is that being put? That's maybe where you're going to see these emerging risks. So those two elements alone, I think, give us a little bit of a clue. We've already found something quite useful to look at. We can actually then think about how some of these characteristics, like we had with the lizard, might just jump across. And again, we'd be looking for the close relationships. So maybe something here would drop across into medical advances. So if I can remember what those characters are, which I can't quite at the minute, we'd be able to create a new scenario, a new risk scenario, by taking closely related characteristics and putting it on top. And that's basically what that approach is allowing us to do, is to make some scenarios now that are targeted. This is not about aliens landing down in Circular Quay. This has got some more rational, some more logic to it, a little bit of a science applied to that approach. And I don't really want to talk about this anymore, except for to say it's a way of clustering, it's a way of putting these emerging risks into families, and how scenarios might come out of those families and would help with that clustering issue, I hope, Richard. We can go on and do other things. This is a full client study that we did in conjunction with Milliman. I can't go into too much detail about what their data is because it's confidential, but what we did add on top of this is looked at the pestle categories. So this is... So this is exactly the same as a tree. Actually, we just put it into a circular to make the, you know, the effect of these additional characteristics come in. So it's exactly the same tree, not as the one you've just seen, but it would be the same. And we put pestle characteristics across that. We've also looked at the impact areas, low, medium, high, of how that might have been assessed, and also the proximity. So is this immediate, is it not? So, you know, this approach allows us to look at well, there's a high proximity, this is high impact. What are those three risks here, emerging risks, that we should be paying most attention to? And that seemed to be really quite a useful way for this particular organisation to start thinking about their emerging risks in a little bit more of a rigorous way. Okay, so then we can, this is, you wondered what you had for breakfast now, you know, we can also take those characteristics that we've got for these risks and compare how like or disalike using network theory. Okay, and here we've connected up, and this was four organisations. We took the sample of four companies coming out of this survey, and we've connected those up based on how close their characteristics relate to each other. And what's quite interesting is the bigger red there would be related to organisation A, and that would be one of their most highly connected emerging risks for them. So for me, that gives that a heightened sense of importance of how you should be managing that cluster, and each one of those organisations has a slightly different one. That's quite useful. What I found much more useful to do with that data once we'd networked it up, and again it's using those characteristics, is to cluster that. So it's exactly the same data now, but now we've clustered this. So we're asking the software, show us the areas where in the same colour they're more connected within that colour range than they are with anything outside of it. So it's essentially a clustering tool based on the network characteristics and how they're connected. And we can break that out and we can look at each of those separately and see what's in those clusters. And I've just put these names on here is planet and human health being one, sort of around this latent and new claims which seem to be in that claim category, clade on the evolutionary approach. Statutory and regulatory change, socioeconomic, technology and personal data. So these are the clusters that are coming out from these organisations, these four, they could be separate business units, and it's giving us a bit of an idea of how that organisation at least sees it. If you add in something like the ORIC database, so you're getting a wider experience, you're doing outside research, you can pull all of those in, use the same techniques to add characteristics, and we get some useful clustering and some useful ways to think about managing these now as groups that have very similar characteristics, which I think is important. Also, once we've got a network, we can do other things as well, which is maybe another form of emerging risk that I think I heard people talking around with the analogy of the butterfly. So something sets something off, which causes a contagion or a domino effect. We can look at that. How, if one emerging risk kicks off, or one characteristic even of that emerging risk starts to occur or be a problem, how might that propagate through that network? What's quite clever when you do these techniques, of course, now we have a model, we can run that as many times as we like, and we can actually find out which are the nodes that create the biggest cascade, cascading failure, the biggest propagation, and we can see what's actually involved in that. We can identify the nodes that are involved in those scenarios. So that gets quite powerful because we have a network and we've connected it. We're starting to look at it as a complex system. So just in conclusion there, really, I think the past is really helpful for understanding the future, particularly if we start being a bit more rigorous about how we categorise things with characteristics. It is possible to spot emerging risks from this, I think, or evolving risks, maybe is my language, and to do so quite rigorously. And for me, and this goes back into my strategic risk work, for me the signs of emerging risk are nearly always there. Somebody knows. It's out there in your organisation or closer. It's a matter of finding that information, looking for it and asking the right questions. So nearly all of the ones that we've looked at can be tracked back to, yeah, people could have, should have known about that. It's not a complete come out of left field. I hope you think that these evolutionary network methods have an ability to focus management effort and management time, and that's really, I think, its main benefit. And the data is already available. You don't have to do anything here, really. You're already collecting that. It's just a matter of tagging that up into certain characteristics. And then you've got really quite a very productive add-on ability to look at it. And these bits of software are freely available. You know, you don't have to spend a fortune on these. Thanks very much.
Any questions? Richard, I had one for you. You talked about storytelling and scenarios. Has there been any scenarios which have particularly resonated with the board in understanding emerging risks?
So the one I think that I gave was certainly relevant in my previous organisation. So we tended to talk in terms of statistics for a period of time, and we had members of the board who were not from financial services. So to talk to them about the impact of an earthquake in a certain location and the consequential effect of that to our organisation but also to society woke their minds to, and they could imagine it, and we could scenario plan it using visuals. That was much easier for them to understand and to plan for than it was a statistical risk.
Thank you. Paul Guignard, Capability Institute. You talk about identifying risk, evolutionary risk, and I wonder whether you couldn't use similar sort of techniques to actually identify the best antidote when you have identified the risk.
Yeah, that's a really interesting idea. I mean, I always kind of look at that face of those risks is that's the sort of the fitness landscape, as you would call it, a fitness frontier. And, of course, management techniques are maybe always trying to alter that. That's why maybe risks evolve. Certainly, if we were to look at fraud and sort of conduct behavioural type emerging risks, then certainly that's happening all the time, I think. You know, they're getting maybe smarter with the technology or whatever to overcome that. So the antidote, that would be interesting. I can't think what that is, but certainly we have tried, and again this was with Milliman, who applied Bayesian nets probabilities to the end of those emerging risks. Based on, you can build that up from the characteristics of those individual events and have a Bayesian network, which you can then monitor over time. But antidote, I'll think about that one. Thank you.
Hi, thank you. Michael Stumbles from Swiss Re. I won't ask Richard a question since I'm sure I'll have the opportunity to later, but this is for Neil. I'm interested in how you characterise the relationships between the different risks. So what are the attributes that go into you thinking that is a relationship? Is it causation? Is it correlation? Is it the same stakeholders are at play? Are there similar themes? What for you defines that two risks are related?
Yeah. So we're purely using the characteristics of that risk to look at the correlation or the connection, as you call it. So the more similar connections you've got. I mean, this is very similar to, you know, Amazon or other bits of software. You buy a book and it suggests a whole bunch of others that you would like because everybody else has read three of the four books that you've already got, so it suggests to you another one. I mean, it's very similar approach in that network. I think the key thing behind that question is how do you arrive at the characteristics? So how are you obtaining those? Now, we've in the past have fallen back onto bodies like Basel and some of the regulators to actually, you know, break that down into what they're looking for. So that's useful, and some organisations do that. ORIC have used their members' knowledge to say what are the key characteristics, and they tag those sort of automatically. So in the description of the risk that's put in there, it's looking for those keywords and automatically tags it. We've done it when we've just used a pestle analysis. We've used characteristics that will be important to that organisation and what they collect and what they monitor. So Don't get me wrong. I mean, getting the right characteristics improves the effectiveness and rigorousness of it. That's how we're making the connections. We're not looking for any causal effect. It's purely based on the number of characteristics that are similar or dissimilar.
Hello, my name is Graham Poyser. My question's for Richard. Richard, I'm just curious to what extent that Swiss Re do any sharing around the emerging risks. It seems to me like you guys are in quite a privileged position around what's happening globally, and you've probably got a wider network than some of the people in this room. So I'll be keen to understand what sort of sharing you do and how you may be able to help the sort of the people on the ground here.
Thanks, Graham. I think sharing starts probably with the data intelligence or the gathering stage. As I mentioned earlier, the more data points you can gather, the better. And it isn't just an internal view that Swiss Re gathers around what potentially our clients or the markets we're playing in might face in the future. So it's working with the universities, World Economic Forum. So the sharing starts there, both in terms of what we're seeing, but also what they're seeing. The formal part of then, I guess, what we share outside of that thinking is there is a document we produce every year called SONAR, and that is a view of what we believe to be the key 21 or so emerging risks and even a couple of emerging themes that we don't even understand at this point. So we can't narrow it down to a risk. It's just one being connected society. So what does that mean for us? And we share that both in a published sense, but also through presentations here and also around the world. So talk to our clients, but also in various forums around what we see as potentially the impacts to, in particular, financial services.
Could I just borrow this to answer the question that was there about antidotes, because I just had the opportunity to think there. I think there's two ways about going this. Is to a certain extent, the characteristic on the most left-hand side, as you would have been looking at that on the tree, so the ones that I was using to characterise that family, that really is the root. So if we were looking for a systemic antidote or a systemic weed killer type approach, if you manage that characteristic and the ones closest to the left-hand side, you'll cover a really good job of managing all of those risks in that family because it's root to all of them. So I think that's one approach. And also is maybe digging down into the characteristics and understanding them better would be maybe an understanding how you can maybe eliminate one or two of those characteristics would be another way of going about doing it.
Thank you. Mike Thornton from AIA. I think this is a question for Richard. You talked about the value of the discussion. So I think this is a difficult area and hard for management teams to grasp. So what would you say is the right amount of effort and time for management teams to spend, I guess, in the discussion? And would you recommend that's a separate discussion or part of a normal risk assessment type conversation?
In terms of time frame, I think there are two aspects to it. One is there's an optimal point at which you start to get into rich conversation. I think it's around the hour to 2 hour mark. I think you start to lose an audience beyond that. So it depends on how you frame, but I think around the two hour mark is fairly useful in a management context and even a board context. I think the second layer to that answer is, though, the more often you do it, the better. So this shouldn't be a once a year exercise. This is something you build upon in a series of conversations over a period of time. And that's where I go back to it's difficult to command that time. So it's really selling the value of both yourself as a facilitator, but also the value of what might come from this. Your second question was...
What's the best way of having that conversation as part of an existing forum or something separate?
Yeah, I think it has to be a separate forum. I found that for existing... So the kind of existing risk management landscape, it's best to do that in alignment with, say, a strategy conversation, mm-hmm. So hand in glove with that. But an emerging risk conversation needs to to step out of the day-to-day. So you need to get the minds right and think about that in a separate context.
Could I add a little bit from my experience with working with companies is that, you know, it is a creative process here, so it kind of needs to be separate from the normal risk meetings. And it is very similar to strategic risk in this way, that it should be not just the central few that are doing this exercise and identification. Maybe the analysis side is a bit more of a selective, but that really needs to get out to the fringes of your organisation, because they might be the ones that are experiencing the change. And as a rule of thumb, I'd say to people, the quicker that particular area is changing, the more frequent you should be having these meetings. So sort of match it up, sort of frequent.
I just had a final question in terms of, obviously, organisations have got a finite amount of resources and you could spend a huge amount of time and effort in emerging risks. How do you balance that at Swiss Re between the emerging versus the existing?
I think we've benefited from the fact we are a global organisation, so we're able to take a centralised view to a lot of the thinking, both externally and internally. So it's facilitated by a central team in Zurich that draws upon specialists across the globe. So rather than every region or every country having to have that conversation, potentially reinventing the same conversation multiple times, there is a certain amount that happens centrally or coordinated centrally, and then it's more about understanding what the impacts potentially are locally and how you then build for resilience locally. So that time is safe for us because of the fact we have got a global network.
No final questions. Well, thank you very much, Neil and Richard, for your time. And thank you all for your questions.